they have come here legally and simply overstayed visas. Also, asylum seekers. Under laws that were passed in 1996, these laws greatly expanded the categories of who can be detained and deported. And under those laws, asylum seekers have to be what's called mandatorily detained. And also green card holders, so legal permanent residents who have past convictions, can be detained and deported. And this is actually a very large category of people who are in detention. But what's important to know about this is that they have served whatever sentence they, you know, have for whatever crime they committed. But under the 1996 laws that I referenced, it greatly expanded the categories of what is called an aggravated felony. And if someone has committed an aggravated felony, then they can then lose their legal permanent resident status and be detained and actually also mandatorily detained like asylum seekers. So it's important to note that this category of aggravated felonies are crimes that are neither aggravated nor felonies for citizens. So it's a totally different categorization of what constitutes a crime for immigrants. And also something very important to note is that people who have violated immigration laws, these are only civil violations of the law. And what this means is that people who are in immigration detention are not afforded the right to a court-appointed attorney like they would be if they were in the criminal justice system. So as a result, 84% of people who are detained in immigration detention centers do not have legal representation. And that's not something that's pretty shocking given our what we think about people's right to due process in this country.
Thank you. Thank you for all that. There's so many wrong things that I want to tackle. And well, yes. First, I wanted to say thank you also for reminding us that that the people in those facilities have strong community ties, and that that many of them actually have a legal status or are asking for asylum. I think that very often in the national debate, this is a very important point that's being lost.
Absolutely. Yes. There's a lot of rhetoric about that this is only a problem of recent migrants, and that's just simply not the case. Like, the fact is that there are not viable pathways for legal citizenship for so many people, and that's what winds them up in this terrible system. Mm-hmm.
And then also clear steps that have been taken for criminalizing certain behaviors potentially that will then remove the legal status of people.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to, you know, say that it's definitely, you know, very tied up in our practice of mass incarceration. Immigration detention is just one prong of that massive system.
Yes, and also the point that you made about immigrants actually being at different facilities with a general population of inmates as well.
Right.
Do we have an idea of how many people are being detained?
Yes. In 2012, ICE detained an all-time high of 477,523 people in immigration detention. And that represents an explosive growth in immigration detention, actually up over 500% in 18 years. And just to sort of, you know, give people a more digestible sense of what's happening, on any given day, 34,000 people are detained by ICE in over 250 of these detention facilities. The majority of these facilities are small county jails that ICE contracts with, but there are also huge privately owned and operated facilities like the Tacoma facility that is operated by the GEO Group, like the Otay Detention Center run by the Correction Corporation of America in San Diego, the Adelanto Detention Center in California, run by GEO. The list just goes on and on. Mm.
So you're saying also that some corporations are making money off of this?
Absolutely.
Clearly.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's definitely what should be understood is that this system is driven by a profit motive. In order to remain in business, these corporations have to fill their beds. They're in the business of detention. And in order to do that, they lobby in Washington, D.C. to fill these beds. And they support and in some cases help to draft anti-immigrant legislation that will ensure them that steady stream of profit. And, you know, there's a well-documented relationship between ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, who was very involved in drafting SB 1070 in Arizona, for example. Mm-hmm. And another thing that a lot of people don't realize is actually getting a lot of attention recently is that we have a quota. We have a congressional quota for the number of people that we have to detain on any given day.
Wow.
And that is 34,000 people. And so that means that this system is not operating based on any kind of rationality, any kind of necessity that people should have to be in detention centers. But that there's a quota that ICE is actively working to fill by whatever means that it can to achieve that goal.
Hmm. And so so you co-founded this organization called CIVIC, and really it aims to end the isolation and abuse of men and women in U.S. civil immigration detention. Can you talk a little bit about why you co-founded this organization?
Sure. You know, I co-founded CIVIC because the immigration detention system resembles forms of discrimination that members of my family experienced in their past as immigrants. And, you know, this legacy has deeply affected all of our lives in significant ways. Since I was 16 years old and became aware of this history, I've been studying the intersections between the immigrant experience, racism and assimilation in this country, and how all these forces interact and how they affect families in particular. And I found through my study of the past that this kind of injustice didn't only live in the past, but is here with us in the present. And it's definitely with us in this immigration detention system. Aside from this personal calling, I, in grad school, did some research on Operation Streamline, which is a pilot program that operates along the border and is actually criminally prosecuting border crossers. And so this is actually separate and different from the immigration detention system, which I explained earlier is just a civil violation of the law. What they're doing along the border is actually criminally prosecuting migrants. And those migrants are being sentenced to terms in federal prisons. So, you know, I went, this program was just getting started, and I went and sat in on one of these court hearings, and I was the only person in the courtroom, and I watched this mass prosecution of 80 people at one time. It took 1 hour, and they were all sentenced to various terms in federal prisons. And I was just absolutely shocked. I just couldn't believe that this was happening and that it was so invisible. And I interviewed a lot of attorneys who expressed how much need there was and how, you know, they could assist people legally, but because of the constraints of, you know, time and their jobs, that's really all that they could do. And so I started thinking about what people like myself, what just sort of ordinary people who are very concerned about what's happening in our backyards could do about it. And I met my partner in this work, Christina Fiallo, who was very interested in doing the very same strange thing of trying to start a community visitation program that's connecting community members to people in detention. And so we started a program together in 2010 called Detention Dialogues, which we still operate in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the more that we started doing that work, the more we became connected to people across the country who were doing similar work. And we started to have, you know, conference calls, and we haven't had an active listserv. And the more that I, you know, became involved with this group of people, the more that we realized that there was just so much tremendous potential in the national network of people working in coordination to intervene on the system.
And what was the something that resonated really strongly with me is your presence at this in this courtroom, and you being the only one. And one of the things that you really try to emphasize with the work that you do with your organization is really ending this isolation. I feel that this is just an issue that people are either not aware of or don't feel concerned about. You know, people end up being sentenced and there's no witnesses to it. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what's the kind of isolation that these people find themselves in?
Yeah. So the isolation is just so extreme, and there's so many different, you know, ways to describe it. So many times I've met people in immigration detention that ask me where they are. They ask me what state they're in. I have met people who have not been in touch with their families for months. I'm talking like 6 months, because their families don't know where they are, and because the people who are detained as a result have no financial support and are unable to even make a phone call. So it's just incredible. You know, when we started our local program in 2010, that year, the government launched what's called the ICE Detainee Locator System. This is a system that allows someone, to family member, to go online and put in the name and birth date and home country of a loved one and look for them in this system. Mm-hmm. But prior to 2010, there was no way to find a loved one who had disappeared into the system.
Goodness.
It was just that they had disappeared, and there was no way to find them, because one of the things that ICE so cruelly does is transfer people all over the country. And it seems that people never stay where they're picked up. They're often transferred across the country, which we have learned as advocates is definitely a tool of you know, forced isolation to cut people off from ties that would allow them to possibly stay in the country. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just this massive system of isolation. Now people can look for their family members, but there's still this, you know, there's a lot of people don't know that system exists.
Mm-hmm.
And even that system is often very up-to-date or incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you know, people, one thing it's important to understand is that people in detention have no idea how long their detainment is going to last.
No.
There's no sense of time. People have no idea whether it's going to be a week. Is it going to be a month? Is it going to be a year? They don't know. That is very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
As I said before, people don't have the right to an attorney. So many of them are representing themselves in really complicated legal proceedings with no legal knowledge to be able to defend themselves. You know, and then in terms of conditions, you know, practices of basically solitary confinement, conditions of solitary confinement where people tell us that they are on lockdown for 22 hours a day is not even a situation that is, you know, disciplinary in nature, but actually just like routine practice in some facilities. There's no areas for outdoor recreation in some facilities. And of course, this practice of transfers where people are just transferred all over the country. People are transferred in retaliation for filing complaints when they're abused. People are shackled and transported in cages to courthouses and airports. I mean, it's shocking.
Hmm.
All of that is part of it.
And I'm just guessing also that there might be also the anxiety of like not knowing what's going to happen. You say they don't know how long they are going to be incarcerated, but are they aware of whether they're going to be deported or whether they're going to be released?
Yeah, I mean, nothing is known in that sense. And that is just extremely, extremely difficult. And, you know, I mean, just to give you a sense of it, I, you know, we have our local program in the Bay Area, and we were having trouble connecting with the women in that facility. They weren't coming down for visits, and the jail staff just told us they didn't want to visit us. And we were like, well, we can't really believe that. Can you let us go into their pod? And, you know, they call it a pod where they're housed. And can we tell them that, can we talk to them in person and explain to them what we're here to do and how we may be able to help? And they agreed. And so we went into this pod, and the guard on staff said, nope, they're on lockdown. You can't talk to them right now. She said, you can make an announcement on the loudspeaker. And so, you know, we said that's not going to be good enough. We really need to talk to them. We really need to explain to them in person what we're here for. They're very afraid. And she said, okay, tell them that if they want to talk to you, they can come to the doors of their cell. And then you can walk upstairs. They were all housed upstairs on the second floor. And you can talk to them through the door. And so we made an announcement in both Spanish and English. And we said, if you guys would like support, please just come to your doors and we'll come up there and we'll talk to you. And after we made the announcement, we looked on the second level of this facility, and there was a woman in every single window of every single cell, pressed up against the glass, wanting to talk to us. And, you know, it's just kind of like visceral moments like those that they're just, they make an impression.
Thank you for sharing that story. You're listening to Bread and Roses. We're going to take a short musical break. We are joined on the phone from San Francisco by Christina Mansfield. She's co-founder of Civic, a nonprofit from San Francisco, dedicated to ending the isolation and abuse of men and women in the U.S. civil immigration detention centers. We'll be back in just a minute. Listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we are joined on the phone from San Francisco by Christina Mansfield, co-founder of Civic, nonprofit that aims to end the isolation and abuse of men and women in the U.S. Immigration system. Christina, You know, there are currently about 750 immigrants on hunger strike in Tacoma, Washington, which is right up the road here from us in Portland. And there's also another hunger strike in a center in Conroe, Texas. Can you talk about the different abuses that the hunger strikers are denouncing and protesting at this point?
Sure. So, you know, from what I understand, I think that in Washington, I've read that part of their demands are practical in terms of detention conditions, being forced to work for less than a dollar a day, poor food, medical care, all of these, very serious concerns. I believe that, they've also stated that they would like President Obama to use his presidential authority in order to stop two unjust deportations that are separating families. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, advocates around the country are calling for. And then, of course, this hunger strike did spread from Tacoma, Washington, to another immigration detention facility in I don't know how to pronounce it, but Conroe, Texas. Mm-hmm. And this is also a facility that is operated by the same private prison facility, GEO Group. And their demands that I've read include stop deportation, just treatment for detainees, ending overcrowding in the cells, end double judgment for old cases. And that's probably referring to what I was referencing earlier in terms of legal permanent residents who are, sort of have this double jeopardy situation. Food with nutrition in it, better medical care. They're calling for lower calling prices, which is something that we've been really active in advocating for, and lower rates at commissary, which is, the store in the prison that, people detained across the country report that they have to use to supplement their diets because the food is so poor.
And we have some an audio piece that you provided. Can you talk about how you were involved with collecting some audio testimonies of men and women in those detention centers?
Sure. So this is part of a project that's called California's New Angel Island. And it's an effort to collect stories from people who we work with in immigration detention, giving voice to their experiences and allowing them to speak for themselves. This isolation makes it so that we never hear the voices of people who are detained themselves because of their extreme isolation. So we just want to do everything we can to give them voice directly to tell us what this is doing to them and their families. And this man, his name is Eric, and I met him 2 years ago. He was detained at the local facility where our visitation program here in the Bay Area runs. And, we worked and supported him for quite some time. And then he was transferred to California City Detention Center. And that's also operated by a private prison corporation. And we lost touch with him for quite some time. And I got a phone call from him not too long ago that he was in Tacoma. And I was just really shocked that he was still in detention because it's been almost 2 years. But then also very glad to hear from him. And so, yeah, that is his testimony.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to the audio of Eric and listen to his testimony. And it seems that since you interviewed him, he was again transferred somewhere else, right?
Yeah. So after actually, he was transferred just days before the hunger strike broke out in Tacoma. He was transferred to a detention facility in New Mexico. Called the Otero Processing Center. Mm-hmm. And he was there for a couple of weeks, I believe, and then he was transferred back to Tacoma, Washington, with maybe a stop somewhere in Arizona, just to give you a sense of like how people are really being just transported all around the country.
Let's listen to Eric's voice. Listen carefully.
Department of Homeland Security, they violated human rights. They better have 24,000 people incarcerated. This is ridiculous. My name is Eric Adrian Vallejo. I'm a Mexican citizen, and I've been in this country for 23 years. I've been paying taxes for the last 20 years of my life, and I've been incarcerated now over 2 years. Due to my incarceration, I've been suffering a lot. I've been in a Richmond facility. I got transferred to CCA in California City. On 11/18/2013, I got transferred to Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington. In here, they don't feel to write. It's more like a punishment. I understand we commit to come in the commanders in the country, but at the same time, I think we should get some kind of relief since we have a strong family values. I think the government doesn't want to separate families. The government should unify families. That's what is one of the principles about this country of America, that we, the people, that should be together, not separate. And I ask, please, the government to release me, even with the ANCO bracelet or ISA program. Anything can do, because this situation is mentally affecting us, mentally and physically. And I'm feeling really stressed, tired, confused. And it's getting emotional. It's getting every day more difficult for me. And I hope that somebody does something about us, because this is ridiculous, like I say.
You're listening to Brad and Roses. I just have to echo Eric's words. This is ridiculous. Really is. We're joined on the phone by Christina Mansfield, co-founder of Civic. I wanted to really look at some of the projects of your organization, because I think that you do a variety of things, and I think what you do is very formidable. Your organization, Civic, meets its goal to end isolation, you say, quote, by building and strengthening community-based immigration detention visitation programs, conducting nationwide detention monitoring, and launching targeted campaigns. So can you talk about some of these projects and how you're able to do these things?
Sure. I think we have sort of a two-tiered approach to our work that I think is unique. You know, our end vision is to put an end to this terrible system and to advocate for that end. But at the same time, we recognize the tremendous need that exists now, every day inside of these facilities. And for us, directly assisting people who are detained and engaging community members in that process, and opening up these facilities to a community presence is the means by which we can begin to advocate for that change. There's been just tremendous growth just in the time since when we started our visitation program in 2010, there were only four other programs in the country. And by 2012, there were 16 programs, all affiliated in a network. And now there are over 30 programs. So it's just been tremendous growth. And we feel that we're really building a movement, and there's coordination among all these programs and involvement of people who are directly affected as well. All the programs in our network are independent. They all operate differently. But for all of them, I think it's safe to say that establishing a community presence in a facility can protect against human rights abuses. And then for programs that focus on monitoring conditions as an overt part of their work, there's just a tremendous potential to make I think there's some statistic that 95% of Americans just don't even know that immigration detention exists. So there's a lot of work to do to make these deplorable conditions known to people. So some of the ways that we're doing that is, so you heard Eric's testimony. That's part of our project, our detention stories project. And we will definitely be releasing many more of those. And another thing that we've been working on is a campaign for phone justice. This is something that if you ask the people that we work with, like what's one of their very immediate needs that's hindering their communication with their families or their attorneys, if they're lucky enough to have one, they would tell you that the cost of phone calls is just astronomical. And the reason that this exists is that private prison corporations who provide the phone services contract with the prison facilities, and they provide a kickback or commission payment for a percentage of the money that's charged to families. So, for example, in San Diego, California, the private phone provider gives the phone service and has an 80% commission that they pay to the people who operate the jail there. So that means that 80% is tacked onto and inflates the price that families are paying for phone calls. So something that we have been working on is a statewide campaign in California. And we've just introduced state legislation that would ban this practice of commission payments between these prison phone corporations and then between California sheriff's departments and also private prison companies. Mm-hmm. This would also apply to youth who are detained throughout California. And the bill is AB 1876. And we're very hopeful that this will move forward and protect the people from this just absolute exploitation on top of exploitation. It's just pretty unbelievable.
Is there a vote coming up for that?
Actually, this bill will be heard in the local government committee of the California Assembly on April 23rd. And hopefully it will make it out of that committee, and then we'll see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, and another thing that we are involved with is a campaign that's being led now by Detention Watch Network, which is an organization that we collaborate with. I'm one of their steering committee members, and they have a campaign to draw attention to this lockup quota that I referenced before. Mm-hmm. That says that we have to detain 34,000 people every day. So there's a lot of movement and media and public education efforts to encourage Congress to change the language that says that, or the way that the government interprets that language to say that they have to detain 34,000 people on any given day, and that we need to be basing it on what's actually necessary, and that is not necessary, clearly.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we have been speaking this evening with Christina Mansfield from San Francisco, and she's co-founder of Civic, an organization working to end isolation for men and women in immigration detention centers. We're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, we're going to talk further about the vision of Civic to actually potentially, hopefully, be in a country where we don't need those immigration detention centers. So stay tuned.
Who'll pay reparations on my soul? Written many directions for the aid that was given. They gave us pieces of silver and pieces of gold. Tell me who'll pay reparations on my soul. was there and the freezing winter's cold. Now tell me who'll pay reparations on my soul. Call my brother a junkie, say he ain't got no job. No job, no job. Told my old man to leave me when times got hard, so hard. Told my mother she's got to carry me all by herself. And now that I wanna be a man, you can't depend on no one else.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. This evening, we've been talking with Christina Mansfield on the phone with us from San Francisco, California. She's the co-founder of civic organization working to end isolation for men and women in immigration detention centers. Christina, your organization has a really clear end goal. Your vision statement says, quote, "We envision a country where no person is isolated in immigration detention." In other words, a country without immigration detention, end of quote. What would this entail, a country without any of these centers?
Yes. This vision would entail abolishing a system that is predicated on profit motives, on fear-mongering, on racism, on human rights abuses, that just creates unbelievable amounts of suffering. A country without immigration detention would reevaluate why currently people believe that it's necessary. The only two logical justifications are, number one, that it's necessary for safety, that people with criminal convictions have to be locked up, or people who are dangerous to society have to be locked up. And number two, to ensure that people appear for their immigration court proceedings and don't abscond. Now, if we take a closer look at these things, they don't make any sense. There was a New York Times editorial this past Sunday that talks about how, the president and ICE really need to make non-criminals and minor offenders the lowest deportation priorities. And this has been tried before in the sense that ICE has issued prosecutorial discretion memos that direct, the people on the ground with ICE to not target people who haven't really violated any other laws besides, being in violation of immigration laws, who have families, who have community ties, who just don't need to be detained. And these haven't worked because they don't carry the force of law and because they're also working to fulfill this 34,000 quota. Another article in the New York Times recently from April 6th outlines how 2/3 of the nearly 2 million deportation cases involved people who had committed only minor infractions, including traffic violations, and had no criminal record at all. And in terms of the concern about absconding, there's no reason why people should have to spend months or years of their lives in prison so that they're guaranteed to show up to immigration hearings. It's just absurd. Mm-hmm. This country spent $5 billion taxpayer dollars on immigration enforcement and detention last year. And that money is paid to the sheriffs or the corporations that house people in such terrible conditions that they profit considerably from it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how anyone can argue that this is a rational solution to those two main concerns that are really the theoretical underpinnings of this system. This system is not operating at this level because of criminals or because people would run away from proceedings that would allow them to stay in this country, which is what they want more than anything. This system is operating because of profit, because we're buying and selling people, and because our government is trafficking human beings, and it needs to stop.
Yes, and again, thank you for reminding us also about how profitable this this industry is for a handful. And And also, thank you for saying that in some ways, unfortunately, we end up contributing to this because this is our tax dollar money that are being used to take, you know, men like Eric from one place to the next for 5 minutes and then 2 days here and then 2 weeks there and then back to where he was for no valid reason, really.
Right.
Well, and yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just agreeing, yes.
But your vision statement also says, quote, to realize this vision, so the vision of a country without any immigration detentions, we believe people from all fields, faith, traditions, ethnicities, and political opinions must engage intellectually and soulfully with the men and women impacted by the system, end of quote. How do we do this? How do we become engaged intellectually and soulfully with the men and women impacted by the immigration system?
Yeah, it's a great question. And definitely what we strive for. I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's about intervening on one's own alienation that allows people to live in a way where people suffer the things that they suffer in isolation from one another. We live in such an unbelievably alienated society, but immigrant communities are not plagued with this problem like more privileged sectors of society are, and we have a lot to learn from them. You know, Civic believes that we have to educate the 95% of Americans that are not even aware of this system. And a great way to do this is to start a visitation program in your community. If you look at the map of detention centers on our website, more likely than not, there's one in your backyard. And I think it's also about really actively building alliances with immigrant communities before crisis strikes. To build a solid foundation of support and respect for diversity. We're holding a retreat for civic members across the country in Los Angeles in a couple of weeks. We're really excited, and I've been reflecting on all the amazing people who have been become involved with Civic and started a visitation program in just the last year, and what amazing advocates these people have become. Mm. You know, I can't even begin to express how dedicated volunteers become and what amazing bonds are formed between them, the people they visit, their families. It's about community building. It's about being the surrogate support system for people who are deprived of their liberty, of their humanity, and forcefully separated from their families. And you know, volunteers that get involved with visitation programs are really transformed. It's really just an amazing thing to watch.
Well, would you actually share with us maybe a couple of examples of how both volunteers who might not have been directly impacted by the system and men and women incarcerated, how have they been transformed by some of the programs that you are offering?
Well, there are a lot of stories. In an effort, I guess, not to speak for the other visitation programs in our network, I can speak to some of the stories that have happened with the local visitation program that I co-founded with Christina Fiallo and lead with Nick Castro. So, you know, I think that we've been able to do a lot of really amazing things. We've been able to advocate for the release of people from detention. We've been able to help assist at least one person every month to be released. And this is because, you know, we find when you create a community presence in these facilities,
yes,
you find people that are not there. They are not the people that the government says they are targeting. And so when we have the opportunity to learn that, you know, we advocate that they are released with community that cares about what's happening to people. And ICE has lots of discretion to do that. If a person is alone and isolated and they can't make a phone call because it costs $5 a minute, they can ask their deportation officer, can I please be considered for an alternative to detention, or for release from detention, and they're going to say no. But if that person has a community of support who's saying, we know that that person shouldn't be there and we're going to advocate for them to be released, then that forces their hand. And so, you know, that's been really exciting to be a part of. And then, you know, in general, volunteers just do some amazing things. For example, one woman ended up driving 6 hours each way to visit someone who was transferred from Sacramento down to California City because she just felt so terrible that she wasn't there for him anymore. Volunteers take people who are detained into their homes so that they can be released on bond. A lot of people are eligible for bond, and they need a place to be able to go to tell the judge where they're going and address. But because they've been transferred across the country from where they are from, their family isn't there to support them. You know, I personally helped to raise a $5,000 bond for a woman who I became really close friends with and who I had been visiting for months. And she had been detained for 8 months, despite the fact that she had 5 U.S. citizen children at home. Those children were lucky enough to be in the custody of her 18-year-old sister. But we got her out on bond just in time to attend a child protective service hearing that was determining the custody status of her children. And that hearing would have proceeded without her if she had remained in detention for just one more day, you know.
And so she would have lost her children.
Some of the things.
Yeah, she would have lost the custody of her children, right?
She may have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very likely that she may have.
I want to applaud you and the volunteers who work with you. And I think that, you know, when we were talking earlier about this intellectual and soulful engagement that you really see in your vision statement, I think that you're role modeling that. I definitely being able to open your house to people, being able to drive 6 hours two-way, to just, you know, for one person, just to be able to feel that somebody cares, that somebody actually really cares whether you're alive or not. That's very meaningful.
Yes.
You know, I can't believe it's been an hour already that we've been talking. There's so much more to cover, but you know, I just wanted to wrap up with you know, an opportunity for you to share some of the ways that maybe people could become involved, maybe start visiting someone or writing to someone in a detention center. Would you have a few pointers for people?
Absolutely. Thank you. So there are definitely a lot of ways to be involved. You know, if people are interested in learning where the detention centers are near where they live, you can visit our website. It's www.endisolation.org. And if you go to resources, there's a detention map. And it's best to open it actually in Google Maps and really sort of zoom in. And, you know, if there's opportunities, if people, there's also maybe an existing program already where you live that you may just want to plug into. And as Delphine mentioned, letter writing is really crucial for people. And it's something that a lot of people can commit to. The visitation policies tend to be pretty restrictive and that they end up being pretty big time commitments in some cases. But yeah, I mean, letter writing is just an incredible act of alliance with people and it really means so much to them, and there's always opportunity for that. So folks can definitely email me personally. My email address is also on the website under who we are, I believe. So. Yeah, I would encourage anyone who's interested to please be in touch with us.
And would you also share some people who are listening have family members or friends in detention centers? Would you share also some resources that might be available for families, or, you know, again, where maybe they might be able to find resources for them?
Absolutely. So there's a whole section of our website. Again, it's www.endisolation.org. And there's under resources, there are resources that are specific for family members of people who are detained. And then there are resources for people who are interested in being visitors or advocates. So under the family resources, there are a lot of different resources. If you're trying to locate your loved one, there are directions for that. If you're trying to respond for them, or there's a lot of resources there. But, you know, also I would say that if anyone has any questions about the system, we're very well versed in all of the very terrible ways that it works. And if folks, you know, wanted to email us directly, we can help you in whatever way is needed.
Christina Mansfield, thank you so much for joining us on Bread and Roses this evening.
Thank you so much, Chelsea, and thank you. It's really an honor.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Honor back. again, to find out more about Civic, you can visit www.endisolation.org. Thanks for tuning in to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists, and we bring you feminist news and public affairs program every Friday at 6 p.m. We always welcome new collective members, so please contact Ani Haynes, KBOO Volunteers Manager, volunteer at KBOO.fm if you would like to join us in hosting, producing, and engineering. You can also find us on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to podcasts. So this show we're just ending will be podcasted there, and Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. I want to thank Chris, our engineer, for this evening. And next week, we welcome back Bread and Roses host Ashley Thurstrop. So have a good week, everyone, and tune back in next week.
Ice, water frozen solid. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE, El Hielo.
Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar. No sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. José atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. Si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal, eso no cuenta para el tío Sam. El hielo anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va.
Fridays, a live reggae music series, March 28th, April 4th, and 11th. Featuring artists Synergy, Adrian Xavier, The Rising Buffalo Tribe, Positive Vibes, Papa Wastik, Jesse Genda, Archangel, and the African Foundation Crew. Roots, Reggae, and Dancehall. Jamaican, African, regional, and island vibes, dancing, and positive community times. For more information, visit hawthornetheater.com. Sponsored by Mellow Mood Pipe, Mike Thrasher presents KBOO Community Radio, Just Some Reggae Folk, and EMET events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Washington County Cooperative Library Services 10th Annual Storytelling Festival, Art of the Story. The festival features five professional storytellers: Bill Lepp from South Charleston, West Virginia; Alton Takeyama Chung from Vancouver, Washington; Olga Loya from San Jose, California; Will Horniak from Portland, Oregon; and Habiba Addo from Portland, Oregon and Ghana, West Africa. The week-long storytelling extravaganza features 14 storytelling performances at various locations, including the Washington County Member Libraries, the Glenn and Viola Walters Cultural Arts Center, and the Washington County Museum in Hillsboro. That's the 10th Annual Storytelling Festival, April 5th through 12th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
If the national media is to be believed, we are now at the 50-year mark of Black civil rights, marked by the 1964 passage of the Civil Rights Act, signed into law by the late President Lyndon B. Johnson. While it is true that this happened, it is also true that for millions of blacks in America, these are not the best of times. For the black bourgeoisie, it has been a rush of opportunity and entree into doors once long closed to them. For the black poor and working class, this is, in the words of legal scholar Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow. They are, she argues, a dark caste who are subjected to targeting, imprisonment, and lack of legal rights that makes mass incarceration in America the phenomenon that stymies the hopes and dreams of millions. For them, civil rights is as ancient and as distant as Reconstruction. They cannot drive in peace. They cannot shop in peace. They cannot walk the streets in peace without some cop threatening them for walking while black. For these millions, what can civil rights really mean? They listen to their leaders and are forced to wonder, what world are they talking about? They feel little elation as politicians and corporate propagandists praise events of 50 years ago while their daily lives are lived in hell. The promises of civil rights are lost in the networks of repression that poisons their days and shadows their twilights. For them, the new Jim Crow ain't so new after all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Greg Bridges, and it gives me great pleasure to be speaking with a woman who has become one of my favorite performers and singers. Not just a singer, she's also an actor and an activist. And I'm speaking of Fatoumatou Diarra, who will be coming to town, appearing at the Norse Theater in San Francisco on Friday, April 18th. How are you doing, Fatoumatou?
Hello. Fine, thank you.
Yes, it's going to be great to have you in the Bay Area again. Really, to hear some of the songs that you sing, your music is so powerful and also so danceable and fun at the same time.
Thank you. Yeah.